You're listening to All Marine Radio on the All Warrior Radio Network. Onward Christian Soldiers is played by the United States Marine Corps. I think that's the Drum and Bugle Marines at General Monday's funeral in a small town in North Carolina. If you've never seen the video, you should check it out. All right, joining us from McAllen, Texas, Tim Lynch. Have you seen the video?
I have seen the video, and it was very cool.
Isn't it? I mean, you see the march, the marching companies from 8th and I, marching through a small North Carolina town, and something you've never seen before. It's awesome. They look awesome,
too. And in the rain, as I recall, too. Not batting an eye.
No, exactly. Looking like they should look. Joining me from Kansas, outside of Kansas City, Will Costantini. Will, have you seen the video?
I have not, but it's on my to-do list as soon as we get off the air here.
It's motivating, and there's a gun salute, too, that's motivating, too. And yeah, that's in the rain, too. And, no, it's General Monday coming, you know, the casket coming out the steps with all the pomp and ceremony. But it's such a contrast because it's in a small American town where he grew up and where he's buried in. They march from the church to the cemetery, which is pretty cool. And they cut a left oblique, right oblique under a video camera, and it's perfect, and the whole thing's awesome. So I don't know why. I like that stuff. I think it's when we roll out our pageantry, it's one of the cool things about the Marine Corps. Jeff, have you seen it?
No, I don't. I have not, but I want to.
Yeah, no, you will enjoy it. All right. I just played 30, you know, it concluded about 5 minutes ago, but an interview I did with an Amtrak captain, United States Naval Academy graduate from Connecticut. Jeff is a nutmegger as well. His name is Leah Domowitz, and came on and kind of filled in blanks in my knowledge and just explained stuff. So Jeff was on Monday. He and I were talking about it. So let me give the floor to Will and Timmy. And your thoughts on, you know, an awful accident off the coast of California, Will?
Yeah, I listened to the piece you did with Jeff, and me and Jeff were on that first deployment together in that Met company, and then just like him as a company commander, I had a Met company as well. So I don't know how many times I've been on the water in AAVs, but it's somewhere between 50 and 100, I'm sure. And, you know, those things are really capable, but if it goes bad, it tends to go bad in a hurry. And if everyone does everything right, it's really good luck if half the guys get out of there. It's just not built that way. And when they take water, they go down fast, and there's just no way to get out. The hatches don't open. You know, the driver, the vehicle commander, the infantry commander are going to get out because you're sitting there. And, you know, we had this discussion about helo dunkers, whatever, some time ago. There is no AB dunker. And it just points out some strange things you get when you form a battalion landing team. You know, boats are in the water, supposed to be in the water. AVs are in the water, supposed to be in the water. Helicopters are not in the water, not supposed to be in the water. To go to a helo dunker, you got to have all a certain class swimmers to go to it. So do you put all your best swimmers in your helo company, although they're not supposed to go in the water? Do you put them in your other two companies? You know, you just can't do it.
Right.
And how much swim qualification is going to get you out of the back of a box that's flooding with almost no escape capability? It's just a really, really bad situation. And I think, as Jeff pointed out, it almost never happens. You know, the first deployment, we were on LSTs, And when you used to come off the back of an LST, you would actually submerge in that vehicle. And, you know, I'd be lying to you if I didn't tell you I said a little prayer every time I went off the back of that thing, because you're underwater in a steel box. It's a little different when you came off an LSD. You're sort of gliding into the water. And while we trained a lot how to egress on land, I can't think of a training exercise you could do to egress that thing out in the water that wouldn't be more dangerous risk profile than just having a catastrophic event. You know, what am I going to put Marines out in the water at night at sea and practice egress drills? It just, you know, and I'm not sure the value of that at that point anyhow. So it's, I mean, it's a horrible, horrible accident. Thank God it's a really, really, really microscopically rare accident. Doesn't provide solace to the families. I know that. But that's sort of the business that we're in, unfortunately.
Timmy, thoughts?
Yeah, I don't have much experience with tracks. I was always in the Hilo company when we were on Muse, and our attention was fixed on getting people swim qualified and through the Hilo dunker seemed to be the biggest priority we had. The only time I ever splashed in a track was at TBS, and that scared the hell out of me. But as I've watched what happened and listened to what Jeff explained to you on Monday, I think the what sticks to me is it's rather remarkable how little of this stuff that we have happened. I've been a little bit on depressed by the current news, so I've been reaching back to my James D. Hornfisher books and reading The Fleet at Flood Tide. You know, when America at total war in the Pacific in 1944. And when they were trying to figure out how to do indirect fire as part of the landing, they came up with a lot of crazy ideas, putting mortar barges, rockets into LSTs, LCTs with tank guns on them. And they took a bunch of these ships out on a rehearsal for Saipan. And on the way out there, it was, I think it was a 2-8 platoon, the LST-485. The mortar rounds, the extra mortar rounds they had in their LCT, which was inside of an LCT, shifted and broke in heavy seas. And the whole LCT got swept over the side of the LST along with all the gun tubs. Lost about 20, 25 guys in that accident. And then the other LSTs turning to assist, they broached. And you had a minor disaster that was ultimately found to be overloading the LST with the mortar ammo. And this is the kind of stuff that we did in extremis when we had to come up with capabilities that you don't ever remotely hear of now. Back then, a couple hundred guys lost on a crappy experiment that didn't work out was the cost of doing business. And we're not even remotely like that. I think that's a blessing. It could also ultimately be a curse. It's kind of hard to say.
Yeah, Jeff, any additional thoughts based on what these guys have said or any other conversations that you've had?
No, but just like what Will was saying as far as trying to put together some kind of training exercise that, you know, kind of approximates what they do in the Hilo dunker, you'd have, in order to make it a modicum of safety, you'd have to make it into something else. You'd have to have like one guy in an AAV. He wouldn't really have to – he couldn't be – you know, dressed out the right way and to produce an effect like that, that is so rare, would be the juice would not ever be worth the squeeze. And I bet you'd lose guys doing those quals more than you would lose than the off accident that happens every 8 or 9 years or whatever. You know, the thing that people got to understand about doing amphibious ops. I mean, like Timmy was saying, there was an accident doing, rehearsal for D-Day in Normandy at a place called Slapton Sands in either early 44 or late 43. And it was they lost hundreds of guys, went in the water and drowned. And it was like worse than some of our amphibious assaults against the Japanese. So, you know, it's just a dangerous business. And any kind of amphib ops, all that stuff, whether you're talking flight deck, well deck, you know, any of that, all those heavy metallic things moving around and everything, and they're supposed to do more than one thing. They're supposed to, you know, sit on the ship and then either swim to shore or fly to shore and then get there and do their job. And I mean, like Will was saying, if everybody does everything right, maybe you come out okay. But it never happens where everybody does everything right at the right time. You know, it's just something you just gotta. You can't say, well, you know, there's nothing we can do about it. You just say, look, we just are as careful as we can every day. And every day you say to yourself, not today is not going to be that day when the odds catch up to us. We're going to do everything right. Everybody concentrates. You know, whether you're doing a live fire, whether you're doing AAV ops. I mean, we were doing at the end of what we used to call the SOCX, everybody who was left at the division, 2nd Mardiv, would attack the Mew doing their amphibious assault. And it was pretty good force on force. I remember we were against 3-2, and the AAV slewed around and crushed one of the 2-2 Marines up against a tree. It was Echo Company 2-2, and the kid's name was Merley because it took him a couple of days to die. And I was Golf Company, but I remember that. And it was Lima 3-2 was the company that was mecked up, and that happened. And I remember it was just they were just felt terrible. I mean, what can you do, though, you know? It's like you're trying to train realistically and stuff like that happens. These huge behemoth vehicles, you know, that go very quick, very fast. They got a lot of fucking power. And the Marines are aggressive and they're doing their thing. You know, it's just inevitable, unfortunately, that you have tragedy even when there's no enemy involved, you know?
You know, Lieutenant Adamowicz, when he was on, he said there is a helo dunker, and I know Will said that. I mean, there is an AAV dunker, and so I just looked it up, and there is one. There is one at Third Tracks down at Pendleton, and it looks like I don't know if guys in the Mew go in it or if it's just for crew members going through school, but it's essentially the hull of an LAV minus of an AAV. Minus the tracks on a crane, and they crane it over the pool, and then it looks like they throw some kind of switch, and it pivots, and it goes upside down in the water, and they
wow.
and they egress. But that's but
yeah, that's for crew,
right? But
you know, there's right. three guys in there, four guys at the most.
Right. Yeah.
There, I would not, as a battalion commander, I would not sanction putting combat loaded Marines in the back one of those things. Right. For training. I mean, that would be very high risk.
Right.
Very high risk.
Okay, well, let me,
I think the crew's got to do it because the crew operates a lot
right.
alone just to do their own training. And it is their job
right.
to try and get everyone out. So they've got procedures.
Right.
You know, your procedure when you're sitting in the back of that thing is when you see light swim to the light. but there's rarely light to see because those hatches don't get open.
Right.
Yeah. Got to make them open.
Right. The, no, I was, you know, things I didn't know that Captain Adamowicz said was, you know, he said, look, there's two, you know, the bilge system is both electrical and hydraulic. In case one of the systems goes down, the other's normally functioning, you know, it pumps 420 gallons a minute out of the crew compartment, you know, and he said, you know, our procedures are, you know, the crewman member that's in the back, you know, kind of like a crew chief on a helicopter, when water begins to accumulate, he's talking to the vehicle commander, and when it gets to the bench seat, you know, we evacuate, and the evacuation drill is, you know, this, I think it's the starboard hatch, top hatch goes open, and then you climb up the radio rack, this grill that's in front of the radios, and that's your ladder out. And so to me, I mean, that was all things I didn't know. And but you can see, and then before they splash, you know, and then before they go from feet dry on land to feet wet in water, they check both those systems, that they're both yeah. both those systems are operating. And the other thing they check is the intercom. And if those systems aren't working, they don't roll. And so Interesting listening to him. Interesting listening to him talk about it, the sequence of the events. But it made you wonder if what would happen. You can see how catastrophic whatever happened was. Is that when you have two build systems with those kind of capabilities, that did they both catastrophically, have some
maybe.
Kind of, and then
maybe.
and then what, and if only those three hatches are open with the driver, the vehicle commander and the troop commander, if those are the only three things that are open, where was all the water coming from? And so, and only the investigation answers that stuff, but you can see the capability of the vehicle is robust, right? Robust. But the other thing that Will said is if it goes wrong in a hurry, the fact that, they had, I would say, eight guys swam away from that thing. Probably the three guys that were in the hatches, I would say those guys probably got out, and then five more in the back, and just like we were talking when the Osprey went in the water, when 23 of 26 get out, I mean, that in and of itself is a miracle. So yeah. Go ahead, Jeff.
Something else that could have happened. When it coming into the beach, the sea state was acceptable for the captain of the ship. They were going out, and they according to the news I read today, they ran into rough seas. They could have they could have gone lateral, in front of a swell,
right.
And that thing could have crested. You know how that ship
right.
comes up,
right.
And they could have got filled half up with water, even if they had a hatch open. Because I can't see even eight guys getting out with none of those top hatches being open. I just can't see it,
yeah.
and so I think, I don't know, I don't want to say because I want to do conjecture, but that rough seas, they mentioned rough seas today, and they didn't expect that, so they might have got shitload of water. If you get like an early early breaking wave or something, you can take a lot of water into one of those AVs if the top hatch is open,
right.
So it's just you just don't know. But again, it's like it is a highly dangerous business for
right,
sure.
Right.
I would say one last thing, Mac, is, no one listening should ever think that people are cavalier.
You want to see
a safety psychopath, find a company gunny down in the well deck or on a live fire range. I think that our safety culture is pretty good, down to some things that seem bizarrely stupid until you think about that could be the thing that triggers when you've got, 40-ton machines moving around. And so, and Marines became very, very sensitive to understanding when vehicles are moving, where they were on the water, in the well deck, on land. There's been some skin torn off the faces of people who thought they were doing the right thing, safety rule, because those things are written in blood. I think there's a lot of procedures and a lot of professionals out there paying attention. And unfortunately, God votes sometimes.
Right, right. No, and the other thing, even if the sea state changed, there was probably somewhere between 13 and 16 vehicles that left the beach, and every one of them gets, to where they're supposed to go except one. So again, only the investigation will tell. But it's been – I know I've learned some stuff I didn't know about the Amtrak and its safety record, and it's pretty robust record, and those guys. I mean, again, and to back up something that Will says, you want to see people get serious when we begin to play "You Bet Your Life" and you're responsible when you say go or no go. You want to see somebody get serious and the jocularity stop. Be in this business. Whether we're on a live fire range or wherever, I mean, it's deadly serious business, and you don't have to be around it very long before you figure that out. So anyway, our thoughts and prayers out to those families. It's the 75th anniversary of the dropping of the atomic bombs. Now, on Hiroshima and Nagasaki, is there anything that you guys have read? As you guys have become adults, that have changed the way you looked at that event? Will?
The more I read about it, the more that the argument that we didn't need to drop the bombs just falls away. you know, Roosevelt, they were projecting, they first wanted to do the invasion in September of 45. They had to push it back to December of 45. And I think they did that sometime in the spring of 45. And they were anticipating that the war was going to last two more years. And that includes the Russians coming in to attack the Japanese that were in China. And you look at the casualties that were in Okinawa. The idea that Japan was about to collapse and we could have squeezed them off and we didn't need to drop the bomb is beyond folly. Those two bombs saved millions of lives and millions of people being horrifically wounded, most of those being Japanese civilians. So anyone who still believes that, you know, Harry Truman was a war criminal because he dropped the bomb, that doesn't pass, you know, the giggle test in my mind at all anymore.
The Will is famous for saying, or at least I quote him often because I kind of look up to Will. Saying that, you know, the whole Black Lives Matter thing doesn't stand the second question. And, that line can be applied here, in my opinion. I mean, if you just do a cursory search of U.S. invasion of Japan casualty estimates, just fire that one into your computer and see what pops up. Right. Personnel at the Navy Department estimated that total losses to America would be between 1.7 and 4 million, with up to 400,000 to 800,000 deaths. The same department estimated that there would be up to 10 million Japanese casualties. Right. Like what now, you know, might have tied the record for the shortest OPT in the history of the world. Tim, your thoughts?
Well, I
or something that you've learned in, since you've become an adult about this that maybe you didn't know or changed the way you looked at it.
Well, the first thing I learned that was surprised me was Paul Tibbetts, when he very first flew in an airplane, was distributing his father's brand new candy bar to racetrack friends in Hialeah, and it was called the Babe Ruth. How about that?
How about that?
So, I never knew
he
that.
He dropped the Babe Ruth on a Japanese boy.
the book I'm reading, The Fleet of Flood Tide, you know, that James Hornfisher book, he's profiling three guys throughout this book. I'm only halfway through it, and Paul Tibbetts is one of them because he played more than just a role as a driver of the bomb. There was a lot of work that he did at preparing for that mission. But regarding the necessity to drop it, what's interesting is the very preface of this book, he's talking about America at total war, and he's talking about the decisions that they had to make when they realized that they're in total war, that they realized that this the civilians there may not be off the table. What they had to start making decisions about what's justifiable in war is being shot by a bullet better than being starved to death. None of these decisions, I think, were codified in the American mindset. So as you read about us coming to preeminence in the 43-44 timeframe, the men on the ground were struggling with this, but nobody that I've read of from back then, with the exception of the developers, none of the men on the ground were struggling with the decision to drop that sucker. They were all about that for the reasons that Will articulated. And so what surprised me most of all right now from my readings, and specifically the book that I picked up in order to flag my, you know, get my spirits going here, reading something decent for a change.
Right.
The thing that surprised me the most was how we had to absolutely modify how we looked at what it meant to go to war, because it was now total war, and all the things that we had done prior to that in respect to civilians, in respect to surrendering, in respect to a lot of things, all that shit went right out the window.
Got it.
And it wasn't an easy decision.
All right. What's the name of the Hornfisher book? We like Hornfisher. He wrote The Last Stand of the Tin Can Sailors, which is about the Battle of Samar, the USS Johnston et al. And what's the name of this book?
The Fleet at Flood Tide. I do believe it's the middle part of a trilogy. I think he did one on Guadalcanal, too, and I forget the name of it, but I'm going to get that next. But the fleet had fled tide America, total war in the Pacific, 44 and 45. And God, can that guy write? Oh, my God, does that guy write? Because he gets down into personal lives, and he's interviewed and has a memoirs of participants. And so you that guy just can write. I'm in awe of somebody who can string together a narrative like that. But this is an interesting book, and the total war concept of what we were going to have to do was not something that a lot of those guys were comfortable with, but they got over it very quickly.
Got it. All right. Jeff, something that you've learned since you became an adult about the bomb dropping?
Well, first of all, I don't know if I am an adult yet, but the jury's out on that one. But
it's really not, just for the record.
I'm sitting here wearing a diaper right now.
Well, we know. I mean, I don't want to tell you the verdict of the jury, but it's not a good one for you.
It never is anymore. But anyway, I think I totally agree with Will about the whys and wherefores. There's just no argument about it. It's the most merciful thing. Even though mercy wasn't on their minds, and I really can't fault them for that because of the nature of the war. But I have to tell you what I have learned in the years since is studying about the guys that developed the bomb. And for them, these guys, these nuclear physicists from the United States, from England, from Scandinavia, and from Germany, there's these guys locked in a battle against each other, a race to see who could develop this thing that they knew from the 30s was a possibility. But, only the urgency of the war brought it to fruition. And that was fascinating to me. All this stuff about, the idea of the need to develop H3O, heavy water and stuff, and plants to do it. Then that becoming part of a military objective, and all these other things in order to get the bomb built as fast as possible. And but at the same time, no one knew when they first tested the bomb in New Mexico. They're like, this thing could start the atmosphere on fire. We just don't fucking know what's going to happen. And at least we won't get beat by the Japanese, So it's like, it's a very fascinating thing, study of, how that stuff happened. You start reading about the history of Oppenheimer and Lawrence and Niels Bohr and what was the guy's name who developed the H-bomb and became real hawk? Damn it. Anyway.
Oppenheimer?
No, not Oppenheimer. Oppenheimer, I already mentioned, but it was he's a immigrant to the United States. What was his name?
It doesn't matter.
It doesn't matter. But these guys were, they were really into it. And the military guy, we had some pretty hefty, military officers in the Navy, particularly, who were respectable nuclear physicists in their own right, and. These guys, they come up with these two bombs, the plutonium bomb and the regular atomic bomb. And it's amazing, how they did it and how fast they got out there after the test happened. And then the irony of the story about the bomb that was brought to Tinian and dropped on Hiroshima, that was the flagship for Admiral Nimitz. And it got sunk on the way back, and that's where you get the Indianapolis story with all the guys being eaten by sharks. Right. I mean, how bizarre is that? You know what I mean?
Right. I went to when I went to be the XO of the Marine Detachment.
The plutonium bomb and a uranium bomb. I'm sorry. Go ahead.
Yeah, when I went to be the XO of the Marine Detachment on the Ranger, I had to go to nuclear weapons security school or something like that at North Island. And so it's just you go into this, you got to get badged in and go through all this stuff to go in there and be cleared to go in there. And so I go to school there, right? And I'm like, what's this going to be like? So it's mostly I'm the only Marine in there. There's probably, 15, people in the class. And salty old, lieutenant commander teaching the class. And he said, okay, first of all, let's talk about the nuclear weapons that have been detonated in against an enemy. There's two of them, right? Everybody knows that. Let's go around the room. How many people think were killed? And we went around the room, and you know, people are like, I don't know, like 300,000, 400,000, but the estimates are all really, you know, relative to the actual number, were extremely high. And so he had, they had terrain models, kind of, you know, fabricated terrain models, and so he kind of walks us through both, you know, both events, and then gives you the total number of killed. He said, look, I'll take the midpoint of the of Hiroshima, which is 100,000, 20,000 soldiers were killed, so they don't count because they're combatants. So you had 100,000. He said Nagasaki, you know, the midpoint is about 60, so total killed 160,000. And it was, I mean, it was like, whoa, that's like way lower than I thought. And he said, so look, he said, when you think of this, when you conceive of this, I mean, think of a large explosion. Don't think as nuclear is a whole lot different, although we'll get to that. It is. But think of massive explosions, blah, 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 blah. And it was just really interesting to me, because I thought that, yeah, it was like, you know, I don't know what I thought, probably 500,000 people were killed. And so, I mean, that surprised me, the number of people, you know, that estimates say were killed. It was much lower, you know, than I certainly would have thought, given, you know, the things that I had read and just my own conception and seeing the, you know, the fireball and all the rest of that stuff. So, yeah, I would tell you this. I mean, I was having a conversation with my daughter Colleen, and she was involved in a debate over, did the ends justify the means or the means justify the end? And this was going to be one of the things that they thought the other side was going to bring up. And I said, well, ultimately, Colleen, it's a humane act. And we're hiking in El Moro Canyon, right, down towards Laguna Beach. And she looks at me and she says, what? I said, ultimately, it's a humane act. And that's what if I was you, that's what I would argue. And she's like, Dad. I'm like, okay. And then I talked to her about the casualty estimates. And she came home, and she came walking out of her bedroom after she started reading about it. And she said, oh, my God. She said, I had no idea about the casualty estimates of invading Japan. I said, how about that for big numbers, especially relative to civilians? Because based on the experiences on Iwo Jima and then Okinawa, nobody was giving up. And she said, wow, wow. Go ahead, Jeff. Go ahead, Will.
I think we killed more people in a firebombing in Tokyo,
yes,
which occurred just a few months before that. We killed 50,000 in Dresden.
Yeah, and Dresden too. I wanted one more thing, because this is going to be a little bit shorter segment. I sent out an article that I saw today that I think is a pretty big deal, and the headline was CAPE nominee Sekhdef Esper blocked the shipbuilding plan to Congress because it lacked, quote, credible pathway to a 355 ship fleet. Now, I mean, to think that the Secretary of Defense would look at something, right, that the Navy produces relative to shipbuilding and say that's not credible, I have to say, certainly caught my eye and certainly broke squelch. So I just want to, you know, we'll start with you. I just want to get your thoughts on this. I mean, and the Marine Corps, here the Marine Corps sits, right, looking for another, some kind of, you know, expeditionary platform that hasn't been designed, approved, or funded yet. And is that in this mix too? You know, what the hell? So, Will, your thoughts?
Yeah, I mean, this is going to get deep into the building a little bit, but you know, you start national security strategy. From there, they have a QDR, the Quadrennial Defense Review, develops the national defense strategy, and then comes out of there the national military strategy, which gets input from the service chiefs, the COCOMs, the chairman, and defense planning guidance. And from there, you're doing the budget. So this office, CAPE, Cost Assessment and Program Evaluation, they're supposed to be the sort of the inside the building numbers people that look at, here's what stuff is supposed to cost, here's what it's supposed to produce, is that credible or not? And so when the Navy builds a shipbuilding plan, which I think is congressionally mandated as well, as sort of a second separate document, in theory, that shipbuilding plan has evolved from this nested strategies and reviews and defense strategy and military strategy. And when it gets to the bean counter number crunchers and they say it ain't credible, that's interesting because those things don't just pop up. There's a lot of work and integration that goes in. But if you look at the Navy, I think this year, $200 or $210 billion budget, they got a $35 billion shipbuilding budget. That 30-year shipbuilding plan is accumulation of many years of budgets. But in $35 billion a year, and they're doing the Ohio replacement, they're building aircraft carriers, they've got missile defense requirements with cruisers. So adding to the fleet is really hard. And then the idea that the Marine Corps is going to get their own sort of separate ships after that, you know, it just wasn't going to work. This may be a really good thing for the Marine Corps because no one's called the Navy out on this plan for years and years and years. And we've been projecting bigger fleets since, a long time ago. And we never seem to get there. I mean, the last time it became an issue, James Webb resigned as the Secretary of the Navy.
Right.
Because he said we were supposed to have, I think, a 600 ship Navy,
right.
And the shipbuilding plan was not credible, and the White House wasn't going to increase it. And he said, this is what I signed up to do, and we're not going to do it. I'm not going to be the face of that. So it's a once in a generation thing. But maybe it's a good thing for us. And I'll tell you who it's a bad thing for, it was Admiral Gilday, because he signed that thing before it went to Cape, I guarantee it. And he got called out in public that you produce something that's not credible, but that's required. So fireworks to follow. Maybe we won't see them, but I think they'll be going on inside the building pretty hot and heavy.
Well, and I have this to say about that in terms of Admiral Gilday. I mean, his recommendation was to reinstate in public. You know, his based on preliminary investigation, his recommendation was not, well, I'll wait till the entire investigation comes back. It was that, yeah, based on what I've seen, I would tend to lean towards recommending that Captain Crozier be reinstated. I mean, that's, to me, how many mistakes do you get as a CNO of that visibility, you know, before we say, you know what, at this level, in this rarefied air, can't do that. Timmy?
Well, I'm kind of alarmed, and I'm alarmed because I, on the one hand, I agree with Will. This could be good news for the Marine Corps as we use the Marine Corps. But what he's thrown out is that integrated naval force structure assessment, which supposedly the Navy and Marine Corps agreed and put forth, and now that's out the window. And Commandant Berger is saying that's okay. We'll get it at the 2022 ship review. We'll get our ships put in there, which I don't think really is a valid plan. But you're now shipbuilding's at the office of the Secretary of Defense level. I'm uncomfortable because I want to believe that what he's saying when he says that the shipbuilding plan does not align with our overall warfighting plan, what I want to believe is he's putting brakes on this radical change of the Marine Corps. But I don't know that. And there's nothing in this complicated process that speaks to that. Right now, we're forced to try to divine through the tea leaves what all this means. And it could mean good news. If you're an optimist, it could be terrible news, but it sure does not speak well to our ability to generate any kind of shipbuilding to conduct total war, as it were, in today's context. I mean, our ability to build ships and get them crewed and out to the fleet is atrocious. And I don't even know that we have the capability organic in the United States. The change of supply could very well extend to China on a lot of that stuff. And so this whole thing makes me very nervous because I don't know what it means, and I don't trust the players are leveling with us and telling us the truth. I just don't.
Got it. Jeff?
Well, I mean, you know, I got more questions than theories about this, because I'm thinking possibly it could be that when General Berger came out with this force design thing, it really alarmed a lot of people in and out of uniform. Guys with a lot of experience, older guys who got all that, you know, experience from Vietnam and so forth. And so I'm thinking, when this thing is happening, Secretary of Defense is basically telling the Navy, you know, you guys, this isn't acceptable. It could be that they're saying, oh, the reason the Marines are doing all this bizarre stuff is they're being forced into it because of the dearth of ships and because of the lack of serious, you know, management of their resources that the Navy's doing. It's affecting the Marines, and this is how their command is dealing with it, with this thing. You know, so that maybe that I can't believe that that's Machiavellian enough, you know, up in the halls of, you know, the people who run the Marine Corps. But maybe that's part of it. And like Timmy says, there's a lot of things you just don't know yet. We never will know a lot, probably, you know, all that stuff Will was talking about, the stuff that happens up there in the building and everything. I got no clue as to, you know, the ins and outs of that.
Yeah, neither do I. The thing that broke squelch for me was you don't see in public it uttered, right? It lacked then the word credibility used, right? It lacked credibility, you know, it lacked a credible pathway to a 355-ship fleet. So that's to me what I saw that and went, whoa, that's like writing rust in the logbook, right? It better be rusty for you to write that shit in there, because that's going to get somebody, it's going to get a whole lot of people that don't pay attention. It's going to get them to pay attention. So anyway, all right. What are you reading that's exciting? Will?
No, I'm still, getting through the Holocaust. I'm into the summer of 44 now. And I mean, you know, the Germans are being rolled back by the Russians in the east, and they still have a huge priority to murder all the Jews that they can, to the point that it's significant burden logistically moving these trains around. But they were so committed to this. And the stories of the people that are just trying to hang on to the end, and some do and some don't, some escape to serve with partisan units, but just this energy that the Nazis put behind eliminating Jews, even while the front was being crashed in on both sides. And again, I know the history, but just thinking through it at this level of detail is something, I'll say that.
Hey, Will, I got a question about that. In reading that book, when they're talking about the first part of the Holocaust in the Soviet Union, all the firing squads, I mean, you know, separate from those, from the vans with gas rerouted into them, to gas people to death, they had this massive firing squad program where they had all these Einsatzgruppen and, you know, middle-aged dudes out there shooting people. And apparently, I don't know if you got to this part or if they have this part in there, Himmler started thinking, you know, this thing may go south for us in like late 43. So he established this guy, Colonel Blobel, a Nazi SS guy who was an architect. And he had him going around Poland and the Ukraine and White Russia, digging up these pits of people.
They were right. Exactly. They're digging them up, burning them. Right. Grinding the bones down to dust, and then sending the Jews that they had doing that to Birkenau so they could gas them. Yeah.
That guy Blobel was like he developed this thing made out of railroad ties and the iron railroad rails. And you make a frame where the frame is exactly, each frame had exactly 6 inches of space between it. Pile of bodies, 6 inches of space, railroad ties and rails, and you did that all the way up to, it was like, so you could put 1,000 people on one of these things.
They were burning them almost 1,000 at a time.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And he's saying, you know, we could do this instead of those stupid ovens, but it's corruption. It's some contractor, probably Krupp or somebody, got money for making those ovens. They didn't need to do that. And, you know, I'm thinking these horrid guys, but it's like a smart way to do a horrifically bad thing. You know, it's like incredible.
All right.
Yeah, it really is. And again, the energy that they devoted to this cost them divisions.
That's what's amazing.
That could have been on the front.
Right.
Yeah.
Divisions and the logistics assets to resupply other things every time they moved one, every time they moved a human being, every time they moved the assets that it took to perpetuate that, took away from their combat efforts. So that part's amazing. Timmy, what are you reading anything good other than Tibbetts?
Well, yeah, no, I just real quick look up the Wikipedia for James Hornfisher. He graduated college in 87. Guy was born in 65, for Christ's sake. That pisses me off because, man, can he write. But that The Last Stand of the Tin Can Sailors is our favorite. I believe I'm reading the second of what's going to be a trilogy. The first was Neptune's Inferno, the U.S. Navy at Guadalcanal, and I'm going to get that next. But I would recommend James Hornfisher to anybody, Texan now, to anybody who wants to read some good history that's really made accessible through the narratives and the stories of the people involved. Yeah. I mean, Jesus, the guy just writes so well. It's embarrassing that I write so poorly in comparison. I try so hard.
Well, you should stop reading Hornfisher then.
Yeah, no doubt. It's an awesome book.
Yeah, read some other schlep and you'll feel better about your writing.
Read my angel.